Hey guys, welcome back to yet another episode of the Premier League podcast here on Total Football Analysis. This is your one-stop shop for anything that is analysis or tactics focused on the Premier League. Obviously, do check out our website as well. It's www.totalfootballanalysis.com, or hit us up on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @totalanalysis. We'd love to hear your suggestions on what you want us to cover on the podcast every week. And obviously, if the Premier League is, you want to look at other leagues, we cover all of those. We cover the Bundesliga, Serie A. We've got quite a lot of coverage on the Women's Football League as well, the Barclays Women's Football League. Honestly, any league, you name it, we probably cover it on the website. And we've got a bunch of other podcasts as well. So do check us out. Do check out all our content. Let us know if you like it. And we're going to be here every week to give you a bit more insight and analysis in the into the Premier League. So like every week, I have a couple of guests with me here. And it's two regulars. I think I can call them regulars now because they've been on. I think this is the second time both of them are on here. It's Mac and Luke, both fellow analysts on Total Football Analysis. So how are you doing, guys?
Good.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, very good.
And once again, it's great to have all of you here. I think today's episode is going to be quite fun because what we're doing is we're looking at some of the teams that are in contention for a spot in Europe next season in terms of where they're going to finish up in the league table and whether they'll have a chance of playing in the Champions League or the Europa League. So we're splitting this into two episodes. We're covering a bunch of teams today and we will cover the remaining teams in the next episode of the podcast. And we're basically going to look at the strengths and weaknesses of those teams tactically and whether they can, you know, those tactics can help them gain a place in Europe, or there is something that will hold them back and they won't be able to make it to a spot in Europe. And obviously, another thing that's really relevant to this is the news we've had over the last couple of days that Manchester City could potentially they have been banned from the Champions League for 2 years, and they obviously are going to appeal to the Court of Arbitration in Sport. And we'll have to see what that verdict comes out to be. But at the moment, City have been banned from Europe from the Champions League for the next 2 seasons. And they've been hit with a fine. And it has been confirmed that the team, that England will still keep 4 spots in the Champions League. So the team that finishes 5th this season is going to end up with a spot in the Champions League. So that makes things a lot more interesting, because obviously that means that a team like Sheffield United or even the Spurs or Manchester United, Arsenal, they all have a much greater chance of now being able to play in the Champions League because they can finish 5th and do so. But we'll get to that, all of those things later on in the podcast as well. Right now, I think we'd like to kick off our analysis by looking at one of the teams that has been an ever-present in the top four, which not many people thought would be the case at the beginning of the season. But at the same time, they've been quite vulnerable, and if any team was to drop out of the top four, it'll probably be this one. And I'm talking about, obviously, Chelsea here. Under Frank Lampard this season, they've done, if you were to look at it in an isolated fashion, they've done extremely well to be in the top four race, given the fact that they've had a transfer ban, they couldn't bring in any players, and they appointed Frank Lampard, who is a bit of a novice at the top level, only had 1 season at Derby County before this as a manager. So the fact that they are in the running is great, but at the same time, they've been quite vulnerable in terms of not being able to finish games out, and even in terms of their tactics, which I'll get into. So I think they're probably the one team that look most likely to drop out of the top four. Also, if you look at the gap in terms of points as well, they're 9 points off Leicester in third, but only a point ahead of Spurs, who are in 5th, although they have a game in hand, which is going to be the game against United, which is tomorrow. So they do look quite vulnerable. And especially when I drill down into their tactics, it seems as if Lampard is imbibing some of the stuff he's learned as a player when he was at Chelsea under Mourinho and Ancelotti, because it's quite similar in this to their style of play, in the sense that both Carlo Ancelotti and Jose Mourinho are known to not coach attacking play. They do not coach specific passages of play or specific movements, or they don't really coach that sort of intricate build up that the likes of Mauricio Pochettino, Pep Guardiola, even Jurgen Klopp to an extent, they don't do that. It's a lot more laissez-faire. It's a lot more it's a lot more individual, in the sense that the players are trusted to be able to come up with solutions on their own, and they're trusted to be able to improvise and find solutions on the pitch, which is great when the team is playing well, when people are in form, they can those things come off. But when you're going through a bad run of form or a bad patch, or things aren't going your way, it's a big hindrance to your attacking style of play if you don't have those sort of movements and positions and patterns of play coached and sort of become automatic, or like not exactly muscle memory, but in second nature. You know, that's not the case with Chelsea, and we can see that in their attacking play. We've seen that throughout the season, to be honest. They've scored 43 goals this season, which is not a lot, to be honest. 25 games, 43 goals, that's this somewhere around mid-table. I mean, if you look at Liverpool, City, Leicester, they've all scored more than 50 goals. City have scored 65 goals, and obviously under Pep, they've been always a bit of a goal machine in that sense. But Chelsea have struggled for fluidity in attack, and that's a lot down to the fact that especially over the last, I'd say, month or month and a half, we've seen them be very unimaginative in attack. It's almost been like the primary tactic is like to get the ball wide and try and send crosses in for Tammy Abraham, or when Abraham was injured, it was Batshuayi who was playing for a bit. So Giroud hasn't really got a look in, but that's been the tactic, that they've tried to send the ball out wide and cross it for one of the strikers, or maybe someone coming into the box from midfield. And while that has helped Reece James has really come on, in the sense that he's been quite an attacking threat for them. That's probably the only advantage or the only good thing that's come out of this, because they struggled to create clear-cut chances. And they've not, I mean, even if you look at their expected goals, they are underperforming their expected goals by 6. So they scored 43, but the XG total is at 49, according to Understat. So that also tells you that they're struggling to finish their chances as well. And I think they've struggled to replace Eden Hazard since he left. Christian Pulisic has shown some promise, but he's not really sparkled. Callum Hudson-Odoi has come back from injury. He's again a young player, inconsistent. And that's basically the case. The fact that they have a young squad, so it is to be expected that there will be a lot of inconsistency. But at the same time, they have struggled to create chances, especially from sort of the center of the pitch or from like an attacking midfield point of view. Mason Mount was actually doing extremely well there at the beginning of the season, but he's also fizzled out. Which again, understandable in the sense that he's a young player, but the attacking structure hasn't helped him as well. It's not coached well enough. And I think Chelsea will struggle to, you know, create too many chances, or even in the Champions League. I think it'll be difficult for them to progress as well. They've got an extremely tough assignment in the Champions League as well. So it remains to be seen in terms of how they do there. But yeah, that's, I think, from an attacking point of view, that's the problem with Chelsea, that they're not coached well enough. And from a defensive point of view, I think I would say it is a bit of a mix between some of the players not being good enough and the coaching not being good enough. They get caught out in transitions very easily because Lampard has mostly favored 4-2-3-1 or 4-3-3. But the point remains that N'Golo Kante is not playing as the deepest midfielder. He plays on the right of the midfield, whether it's a duo or a three-man midfield. So he pushes on a lot more. He's more of a box-to-box player. And he's done decently in that role. He's done a lot better than he did last season under Maurizio Sarri when he was deployed there initially. But at the same, it's not playing to his strengths. And especially when you've got Jorginho as the deepest midfielder. Again, Jorginho has also done quite well this season, to be honest. But it takes away something from Chelsea's defensive play when Kante plays as the right-sided midfielder and he plays as a box-to-box player as opposed to playing as a pure defensive destroyer, like which was how he got his reputation at Leicester and even under Antonio Conte at Chelsea.
Have you noticed much of a difference in terms of how you think that? Because obviously they've kind of swapped between 3-4-3, like a three front three formation, sometimes three at the back, sometimes four. Have you noticed, you know, a difference between the two and one that you think maybe works better? Or do you think Lampard's changing it dependent on the opposition as well? Or do you think it's more been a case of him trying to find what's going to work for Chelsea and what gives them maybe a better attack going forward? And like you said, maybe a bit stronger in transition. What would you say, from your opinion, would that be?
I think it's a mix of both, in the sense that Lampard is probably has tailored his tactics to suit the opposition or the team that he's playing. So you're right, he has played a back three on occasion. He has played three up front on occasion. So it's completely dependent on the opposition that he's facing. If I remember correctly, I think they played a back three in the game against Sheffield United. I think they played a back three in the game against Wolves. So they've adapted. Lampard's adapted his tactics in terms of the opposition he's facing, which is again something which I think is very Mourinho-esque, very, and to a lesser extent, something that Carlo Ancelotti does as well. But Mourinho is known for adapting his tactics to the opposition. So that's again something he's learned, I guess, from those managers who he played under at Stamford Bridge. But I think, in my opinion, what has worked the best for Chelsea has been a 4-2-3-1 where you have a number 10, you have a creative player there to put on the chances, to create the chances for your strikers and the wingers, especially because they don't have that sort of prolific goal scorer or even a prolific attacking midfielder or winger, you know, who can chip in with a number of goals this season. So you need to create a lot of chances, I think, in this Chelsea side to be able to score a goal. And
well, that's it. Like, I think you look at, when you look at Liverpool, they've got so many options in terms of at least five players, just looking at the two fullbacks and the front three who can create chances. Whereas you look at Chelsea, and for me, that was always the thing with Ross Barkley, was can he take that step? I think for Ross Barkley to go and be a top player that everyone in England wanted him to be, it was like you said, can he produce that output of goals and assists? And I don't think he's really quite taken the step. Mason Mount's done brilliantly considering the level he's played, and he's going to get better and better. Same with Tammy Abraham. But it's like you said, for them to be challenged in the top four and do well in the Champions League, I feel like they still lack that little bit of quality. Willian, you know, I like him, but whether or not he's got enough to really propel them into, you know, top four and do well in the Champions League, I think's always been the thing. And then obviously the transfer window bans come, so it's made it definitely tricky. But he has done well with what he's got.
Yeah, exactly. So it remains to be seen as whether, I think they will still manage to keep hold of a top four spot, but it'll be difficult because Sheffield United, Spurs are making a charge for top four. And I think, again, they've also got a bit of an insurance policy in the sense that even if they drop down to fifth, they could still play in the Champions League because City have been banned. But at the same time, I think they're the most vulnerable to missing out, I think, in the current top four, because the rest of the three aren't going anywhere. I mean, City are going to finish in the top four, even though obviously that's not going to lead to them playing in the Champions League next season as things stand right now. But they are still going to be in the top four. And Leicester and Liverpool are also obviously going to be there. So Chelsea, I think, are the most vulnerable to dropping out based on their tactics as well. Because, like I said, even defensively, they've not been solid. They get caught out, and it's so evident that they get caught out on the counter so easily. It's been evident since the opening day when United beat them 4-0, and it was all quick, fast, direct, rapid counter attacks. And that sort of problem has kept on occurring till where we are in the season now as well, where at times it's they have a corner and you see the opposition breaking with like 4 players on 3 or a 3-on-2 because they don't have enough defensive cover. And I don't think the likes of Antonio Rudiger, Kurt Zuma, Christensen, they're all not at the top level yet in terms of their defensive positioning, their understanding of the game, their reading of the game, when to step up, how to play as a unit, and all of that. I think there's a lot to... I mean, this Chelsea team does have a lot of potential. They have a really high ceiling, in my opinion, but they're still learning. They're still... it's going to take a while for them to get there. And I think Lampard will have done a fantastic job if they manage to finish in a Champions League spot this season, because he has a very young team. Although, like I said, a lot of it is down to his tactics as well. I think he needs to go back to the training ground or to his blackboard or something and work something out in terms of how to be a bit more solid, as well as be a bit more creative and a bit more dangerous in terms of creating chances. So, yeah, in terms of Chelsea, I think that's what I feel, at least tactically. They've got a lot of work to do. But at the same time, given the points difference and where they are in the table, I think they will still finish in the top four and they will be in the Champions League next season. So that's one team. The next team that we would like to look at is going to be their London rivals, who are obviously Spurs. And as I said, Spurs are fifth in the table right now. They are a point behind Chelsea, I believe. Yes. They are just having won the game against Aston Villa. We're recording right now. I think the Aston Villa game finished about half an hour or an hour ago. And they came from behind and won the game 3-2. So that, I think, will be a major boost for Spurs as well. But in terms of tactics, I think, Mac, what do you have to say? What do you think about Spurs and their tactics and the Mourinho strengths and weaknesses? And do you think they can finish in the top four this season?
So I'm going to talk about Mourinho's Tottenham in terms of their collective performance and individual performance. But I think both ends are related, because there's strong relations in the choice of players, because Mourinho was a little bit unlucky because Moses Isoko and Harry Kane were injured when the time he came, and now both players are very likely to be unavailable for a long period, and Mourinho had to adjust his tactics a bit. So offensively, I think everyone knows Tottenham how their attacking shape is going to be, because I think, except for the City game and Liverpool game, against other opponents, all Tottenham games they play in a 3-2-3-2 or 3-2-4-1, whatever, the attacking shape would be the same. No matter it was a back four or a back three, because for a back four, they just shift the left back to the center and make it as a back three. For a back three, they have three center backs, so it's a back three, 3-2 something, and two pivots in front of the defenders for the build-up phase. And then they push a wide player on the left, and usually Sergio Aurier on the right, and they capture front players free at front. So I think it's a very predictable attacking formation for the team to play. And I think most managers will get how Tottenham are playing offensively. And I think in the future, maybe in April or March, there may be some matches that Tottenham would be struggling because their attacking mindset or movements are too predictable for the opponents. And defensively, of course, Mourinho, I think he chose his attacking shape or attacking tactics because of the defensive consideration, because Spurs are not very not doing very well defensively recently, especially this season. And for Mourinho, he's very he likes the word compact when describing the defense, no matter the press or the block. So Mourinho wants his player to keep a close distance between each other. So if you attack, for most possession-based team, you have to open your shape to stretch the pitch, get the pitch as big as possible. But also at the same time, you are vulnerable in transition because your players are getting far away from each other. When your opponents hit you in the fast transition, you are unable to cover the spaces between players because the ball is always going faster than the players. So you will be under, you will be fragile in the counter attacks if you played in a possession based wide attempt. So for Mourinho's tactics, he is defending with at least five players at the back with his build up phase or his attacking setup. So I think it's a very conservative setup for him. And sometimes if the team pressed, for example, we saw in the FA Cup Southampton game 3-2, Tottenham won 3-2, and I think when the pivots are unavailable to receive a ball, I think Tottenham will not bother to insist to play out from the back. They just kick long and find Son or find Mora to let the front players to decide for themselves. And yeah, somehow I think they could be struggling in the positional plays if they are playing against a low block, because once again, I have to mention their attacking form is too predictable so far. And defensively, I think they are doing a better job than under Mauricio Pochettino this season, because they are being more compact defensively, especially staying in the back three. And usually it was Sergio Reyes' side to stay slightly forward and joining the press. So the ball was likely to shift to the left side of Tottenham defense. And for the front players, on occasions they pressed, but not very intensively. And when they pressed, they try to, of course, for example, the Southampton game again, they try to block the pivots. But when the ball moved wide, I think they move Wings or Dyer forward to, in joining the press, they are not marking the pivots tightly. So somehow they are still struggling to accommodate between a press or a block or a deep block, because on some occasions you are playing weaker opponents, you can't just stay a low block. You have to be more active. You can't stay too passive. I think Mourinho still needs time to tune his setups, but we are going to reveal the performance of individual players first, because they are very vital to the performance, because we saw Harry Kane and Sissoko both suffered from severe injuries and they are unavailable for a long period of time. And to maybe it's a solution for Mourinho to change his shape, he changed the team formation to a back three given the injury of Kane. So they have two players up front, Mora and Son. And I think this change is necessary, but it's not optimal, because both players are not the best strikers to play back to goals, because I think both of them are better to stay on the wing, the wide areas, or maybe they are playing better in the counter attacks. And I think for the long balls, they do not receive the long balls very well. I mean, Harry Kane, maybe he can serve as a target man, but not Son and not Mora to serve this function. And in terms of pressing, I think these two players are better. But again, when attack, I think Mora is slightly better to attack with spaces, because he's good at escaping his marker or turning quickly. But in terms of creating spaces for himself to shoot or finishing or maybe attacking the box, I think Mora is not the best player to do this. And so I think they are putting two players here to play together. I think they try to keep one out of the box and one at the front line to push the defenders deeper. So it could be an intriguing combination, but I think it won't be a long solution. So for this front line, that's it. And I have a little bit criticism on two players, mainly on Ndombele, because I think it looked a bit weird to criticize such an expensive signing of Tottenham Hotspur, because I think quite a number of Spurs fans would like Ndombele because he's a physical player with strength and a little bit of dribbling skill who can take on players at the midfield and have some good footworks for us to look at. But for me, or maybe for Mourinho, I think Ndombele is not doing enough defensively, because I think his defensive awareness is not really that good, and for his coverage on the pitch, he is not an energetic player like Sissoko or Wanyama seasons ago. So Ndombele, maybe he's not getting a spot under Mourinho because I think his feature or his playing style is not quite fully fits into the team now. You can't really find a position, because for example, I watched the game against for Olympiacos against Spurs in September this season, Champions League, the group stages. For that game, Spurs get an early lead for 2-0, and then they just let this lead gone by dropping the 2 goals away. And I think Ndombele are the one to blame, because he just let the players run behind him. He had a very weak sense of protecting the space behind him, let alone covering the shadows, shutting the passing lanes. I know Olympiacos have good players, Valbuena or Daniel Podence, who has joined Wolves recently, but I think Ndombele defensively is not doing enough, and it's just awkward to put him into an attacking midfield position, as from the Southampton games we saw, because he's not a really creative player to provide the inspiration passes at the final third. So, and Mourinho got Dele Alli in this position, so I think Ndombele is somehow in an awkward situation. Maybe he had to wait for his chances. For the new signings, I think Spurs make two very important signings in the winter transfer window. First is Bergwijn, because I think usually the left winger or the left player on the left channel, he have to occupy the whole flank, because the left back or the left center back is not going to support him, and he has to be strong in terms of dribbling or taking on players or creating something on the flanks. As we see, Ryan Sessegnon on several occasions he played, but I think he's not really that good for an offensive player. And that will make Spurs' attack very predictable or very weak, as they cannot progress the ball on the right, on the left flank. So signing Bergwijn maybe gives some flexibility for Mourinho to change the shape back to a back four or playing him on the left wing. Also, Jadson Fernandes, I think he's passing nicely, but I think he needs more time to suit the playing style of Mourinho or the team. Another point of question, I think, is the right backs or the right wing back, Sergio Aurier, because he's a very physical player again, but I think he's not really hitting the standard that for a very strong right back or right wing back who should have, because he's having a very important responsibility under Mourinho, because he has to attack and defend on the right flank in his own. Not many players are going to help him on the right flank. He has to do all that alone. But when it comes to 1v1 situation, I think Sergio Aurier is not the best. And when it comes to crossing, he's also not the best. So I think in this moment, he's only the option of Mourinho, but in the long term, I think he won't be the option. So it could be a defensively, I think Sergio Aurier is okay, especially he have the back three protecting him. But offensively, I think Tottenham need more strategies to attack instead of just letting Son or Moura playing freely, because sometimes they may be not in the good form to score the goals. And apart from the offensive parts, they maybe have some little problems. I think that defensively they also have some problem, because Vertonghen has dropped a bit recently, and yeah, he was replaced by Fernandes, if I remember, in the FA Cup game. And his lack of pace or not in good form may be an exposed player for Tottenham if he was on the pitch. So I think both ends of Spurs have a little bit problem, but I think overall they could secure a top four because Mourinho is an experienced manager and he can adjust his tactics to play against different teams. But a little bit problem, but I think it's generally is okay.
Yeah, I mostly agree with what you said, Mark, but just one maybe counterpoint is that I feel actually that Ndombele has struggled this season more down to due to fitness issues rather than any other thing, because I think even Mourinho's called him out, I think, a bunch of times in press conferences and otherwise. He's not happy with how with his fitness work or whatever. You know, he barely is able to last 90 minutes and all of that. So I think that's more the reason why he struggled, because at least I feel that Ndombele is actually quite a good fit for this Spurs side if he can get up to speed fitness-wise, because he has, as you said, he's physically imposing, and he's powerful and all of that, but he also has a good passing range. He is good in terms of getting into the box. So he can be a good box-to-box midfielder if he gets his fitness up, I think. And that'll be quite interesting to see in terms of how Mourinho integrates him into the team. But that, I think, is more to do with the summer when he has a proper preseason, I think, with this Spurs side and all of that behind him. And secondly, another thing is that I think they've struggled since Harry Kane got injured, because obviously he was the only sort of striker in the squad, and he is one of the best strikers in the world, probably. So any team is going to suffer when they don't have him. But I think Giovanni Lo Celso will play a really important role in Spurs' season going forward, because he has, and we discussed this on the transfer podcast that we did earlier as well, that he's had that sort of half season to sort of bed in, and because he was injured, but that gave him time to adapt to life in England. He made a few appearances off the bench and all of that, and by the time Mourinho was appointed, he was more or less up to speed with the game in England at least, and he's been quite good for Spurs over the last, I'd say, six weeks or so, whenever he's played. Because he can obviously play as that number 10, but he can also play in coming off the right, and he will fill that creative void that they've got in the squad now because Christian Eriksen has left. I mean, arguably, they've had that void since the beginning of the season because Eriksen was basically not there, even mentally or whatever. You know, he was on his way out, so he was not really there, and they've been carrying him as a passenger or whatever in the squad. So, but Lo Celso will, I think, fill that void in terms of a creative force for Spurs. But you're right, I think they will make the top five. I think we should call it this season now, because the team finishing fifth will play in the Champions League next season. So they will, I think, play in the Champions League next season, as you said. But there is a bunch of work for Mourinho to do as well, as we spoke about Lampard earlier. So yeah, that's all I think we can talk about with Spurs. Moving on to the next team that we're looking at today is actually a bit of a surprise, because it's Everton. And if you looked at the table in December, or basically over the first half of the season, there were obviously fears that Everton could be involved in a relegation fight. But it tells you how tight the Premier League table is this season, and how all the sort of mid-table and lower table sides are taking points of each other, that Everton put together a decent run of form under Ancelotti, and they're now in contention for a Europa League spot. They're very much in contention for a spot in the Europa League. They're what, eighth right now? Yeah. They've got 36 points. They're level with Wolves. And they're just 3 points off Sheffield United. So they're actually, and they're ahead of Manchester United at the moment. They're a point ahead of United. So they're right in the thick of the race. So, Luke, what do you think? Obviously, tactically, what has Ancelotti done here? And do you think this is sustainable? Do you think they can get a place in the Europa League this season?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, it was such an interesting appointment. I know probably shocked you guys a little bit, because it definitely shocked me when Everton managed to bring him in. I think that says a lot about kind of the project they've got, how much financial backing, what Marcel Brand, the sport director's kind of got in mind for the club. He's obviously got really good experience behind him and someone who was highly touted in kind of the football circles before he went to Everton. So I think the impact of Ancelotti is kind of twofold. There's a tactical component to it, as always, but there's also, I think, been a lot of chat about how he tends to have a calming effect on the players. He's one of those managers, he's not possibly like a Jurgen Klopp who's tearing up and down the sidelines and passionate. He tends to be quite a bit more reserved. And I think you can see that he's kind of come in straight away and just steadied the ship. And I think a compounding factor to that is the fact that he has such a brilliant CV. And with that comes a bit of extra trust from the players. And I think they've just come in, you know, we're not 100% privy to what goes on behind closed doors, but I think that calming effect has had the players kind of build trust with him and the system he's brought in and how he's wanted them to play. It's an interesting theme, I think, going throughout this podcast in terms of pragmatism. We talk about Mourinho, who's a manager who spoke about in those terms, Frank Lampard, a manager who spoke about in those terms, and Ancelotti's another one who you would call a more pragmatic manager. His teams tend to play in a similar style vein, but they don't have a set, you know, formation that's kind of stuck in concrete in what they're going to play. And already shown that coming to Everton, he's set them up defensively, they're usually in a 4-4-2 no matter what, but offensively, they've swapped between a 3-5-2, a 4-4-2, and a 4-2-3-1. In one of his first games, he actually, on paper, it was a 4-4-2, against Burnley, but then when you see kind of what they were doing in possession. So the 4-4-2 lineup was Coleman, Mina, Holgate, Digne at the back, Delph, Sigurdsson sitting in more of a deeper role with Bernard to the left and Sidibe to the right, and then Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison up front. And they would defend in a 4-4-2 block, occasionally pressing high, alternating between kind of pressing high and sitting in a deeper block if they didn't have great press access. But it was really interesting the way he set them up into a 3-5-2 that we kind of saw similar to when he was in Napoli. And in this way, you'd have Coleman would come in and play as a centre-back, kind of like Kyle Walker does with City, and Digne and Sidibe become the wing-backs. And it was a 5-3-2 shape, Delph sitting deeper, Bernard and Sigurdsson in more freer roles, and then Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison leading the line up front. So that was one kind of formation that they used, and that one was very much predicated on getting overloads in wide areas. You could often get the fullbacks with a inside midfielder and one of the strikers coming across and overloading. Especially against Burnley, they tended to overload the fullbacks quite a lot, and the shapes also morphed. You could call it a 3-4-2-1 because Richarlison has a tendency to kind of drop deeper, and then Sigurdsson was dropping a little bit deeper. So they have a lot of fluidity in the way they've been playing. And especially in terms of the style of football in possession has been a lot more fluid. They've been not privy to going maybe one a bit further in terms of playing a longer, more vertical pass. Ancelotti came out in the press and said how one of the things he thought Everton needed to do much better straight away was playing more vertically. And I think sometimes under Marco Silva, the murmurs from people around who were watching the games was that it was just like shadow play. And they were just going back and forth and very much predicated on a possession-based style of play. And I think Ancelotti's changed that. And you've seen a few of the match-winning goals have been, you know, longer ones, which have been played into the space for Calvert-Lewin or Richarlison to get onto, who are both kind of good pacey strikers and can seek the room in behind, especially Calvert-Lewin. And that's something Ancelotti, you know, excitingly, I guess, for Everton fans has said that he thinks Calvert-Lewin can get even better at, is that movement behind. So they've played that 3-5-2. They've played a 4-4-2 where they'll have kind of two inside wingers, the fullbacks bombing along. They've had, since Walcott's come in, he's established himself more, which has seen Sidibe or Coleman kind of swapping in and out. And Walcott obviously gives that option to play a bit wider and hug the touchline, but also to go in behind and play shorter. So there's been a lot of variability in Everton's play. Defensively, you wouldn't say he's exactly, you know, steady the ship. They're still conceding a fair few goals, and we've seen some moments which have been kind of like the old Everton when, you know, they've had a two goal lead and lost that and those type of things. But in general, they've looked a lot more safer. Morgan Schneiderlin's really established himself recently as a key player for them and has been exceptional in breaking up play. So there's definitely some really promising signs for Everton fans. I mean, just looking at the form table, they're flying. So it was probably only, you know, Liverpool who have had stronger form, I would say. They haven't lost in the last five matches. So there's definitely a lot of potential, I think, for them to push for those spots a little bit higher up. I mean, Sheffield United, the question is, can they continue? It's been an unbelievable story. I could see Everton potentially, because I think they'll get better and better under Ancelotti. I could see Everton, you know, improving even more, probably be a dip of form at some point because maybe their form's a bit unsustainable. But I definitely think they're a good chance. And with an extra spot in there as well with Tottenham, with obviously City, and the Champions League spot up for grabs now, it's really going to be an interesting one. I see them having a little bit more than Wolves on current form. I guess the worry potentially for Everton fans is that they haven't, bar Andre Gomez, had a lot of injuries this year. And you've got Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison who have, since Ancelotti come in, been the ones primarily scoring goals. I mean, their goals have really... both of them have exploded since Ancelotti have come in. But if you look, you know, at their team, it's only Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin who are scoring, and the closest is Bernard with three and Yerry Mina with two. So that would, I guess, be the worry for Everton fans is if potentially one of those players gets injured, is where the goals are going to come from. But yeah, I guess it's in this day and age, there's so much talk about having a system, and rightly so. You see the best managers around have kind of a clear style and way of playing. But I think it's really interesting how Ancelotti is pragmatic in that sense, that, you know, he's happy for teams to set up in different formations and even, you know, to the extent, to the spectrum of how much they play in terms of how much possession they keep and how direct they are. He really, I think, is one of those managers who looks at his players and he looks at his players and decides, you know, how he's going to play and allows them to kind of dictate within reason, you know, his style of play. He's always, you know, had teams who press a little bit higher, but at times they will sit in, like I said, if they don't have good access to the ball. So it's been a super interesting one, super exciting, I think, for Everton fans after what's been a lot of heartache over the last few years. So, yeah, it will be interesting moving forward to see whether Ancelotti can keep the ship kind of going in the same fashion. So, yeah, that's kind of the roundup with Everton.
Yeah, that's, as you said, I agree with almost everything you said there, that Everton have been quite interesting tactically. A couple of points, at least on the tactical side of things, that I have noticed from looking at Everton is that they have, like you said, formed a back three, or not a back three exactly, but they've played with like a they've formed a back three in possession, which has allowed the fullbacks to get forward. And over the last few games with Schneiderlin playing, it's basically been Schneiderlin who's been dropping into that back to make it a back three along with the other two centre backs, which then allows the fullbacks, whether it's Dine on the left and Sidibe on the right, or whether it's Coleman on the right, but they can get forward. And Everton, I think the best sort of their best source of creativity this season has been from the flanks and down, you know, from the fullbacks. especially Lucas Digne. He's been one of the best in the league at left back, I think, over the last 2 years, especially attacking wise. But even Gibril Sidibe has come on leaps and bounds. And obviously, you've got Seamus Coleman, who's a veteran, who's been there, done that. He is good at that job, you know, of overlapping and sending crosses in and all of that. So they've done a really good job, I think, in terms of maximizing their strengths and allowing the two fullbacks to get forward as much as possible so that they can create chances.
And I think that's the benefit of having, you know, somewhat of a more pragmatic coach, is that he has the ability to come in and say, this is our strengths, this is our weaknesses, let's strengthen our strengths, you know, and make sure that we limit our weaknesses as much as possible. And I definitely think Ancelotti's done that really well and in a really interesting way. Like you said, Coleman also, if he can play centre back, adds a bit more variability to their play. So it's definitely been interesting, you know, for me watching a manager that you hear about how he is when he takes over teams, and it's so interesting to watch him come into a side, make that judgment on how players play and then how he goes and sets them up. So it's been brilliant from our point of view with the tactics and whatnot.
About just a quick say about Ancelotti, because I think in terms of tactical versatility and experience of this manager, he's very, very good. And he has a lot of experience in the Champions League, in Serie A, in La Liga, or even back to the Premier League. He coached Chelsea and obtained remarkable results. And I think from now on until now, Everton under Ancelotti had made some important changes to upgrade the squad or maximize the strength, as you said. For example, this season, Gylfi Sigurdsson isn't too good in form in terms of finishing, because last season he's scoring a lot, and now he just got, I think, two goals from now on. But last season he scored over 10, and he just put Sigurdsson slightly behind, getting him away from the final third. So playing him, but also avoiding the mistakes or avoiding the weakness of him this season. I think this is a very clever movement.
Although, to be honest, at least speaking about Sigurdsson, I saw this on Twitter recently. It was there was an article about Everton's midfielders, and it had like the passing sonar for, I think, the five midfielders who played the most for Everton this season. And it was, and even the guy who wrote it, I can't remember right now who the author was. Or, I mean, I would have credited him here. But basically, the what was surprising from the sonars was the fact that Sigurdsson has been a lot more conservative in terms of his passing this season. Most of it has been sideways, a bunch of it backwards. He's not passing forwards or, you know, in terms of direction, and nor has it been direct. In terms of the passing length, you know, he's not really, even when he's played in a deeper position, it's not like he's been able to send passes out long or been able to influence the game in the final third as much as he would like to. And I think it's the start of a decline for him. I think he's getting on, and I don't think he's at that level where he was years ago, where he was, you know, one of the best goal scoring midfielders in the league. He's certainly not there, but he's declining as a creative force as well. And from that article, again, what was surprising to me was the fact that Tom Davies has been their most creative midfielder, at least if you look at in terms of passing direction and passing length and all of that, that he's the guy who was attempting the most passes forward and trying to make something happen. So, yeah, that's quite interesting. Let's see where it goes and how Everton are able to capitalize on maybe Tom Davies' strengths and if they can get Sigurdsson out of the rut that he's in. But you're right, Luke, when you said earlier that Everton, if they continue this sort of vein of form and they can keep it up, they might even be able to sneak into contention for a Champions League spot, because obviously even if you finish in fifth place this season, you can get there, and they're only, what, three points behind Sheffield United at the moment. So yeah, even that, they might even be in contention for a place in the Champions League. That was Everton then, and the last team that we're looking at today is, I don't think anybody would have thought that this team would be in contention for a European spot at the beginning of the season, and Sheffield United. It's been a brilliant season from them. People obviously all the talk around the overlapping center halves and all of that is that's all the noise that was around the club and his and Chris Wilder's tactics when they came up. But there's a lot more to Sheffield United than that, and they've done extremely well to be where they are. But again, like you said earlier, Luke, I think it's going to take a lot for them to stay there, and they probably, I think they've done enough to maybe get a spot in the Europa League, maybe. But if they could manage to sneak into the Champions League, that would be some story, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if they can do that, I feel sorry for Chris Wilder, because if Klopp wasn't around and Liverpool wasn't being one of the best teams we've ever seen in the Premier League, he would hands down have won, you know, he'd be winning the Manager of the Year. So it's a remarkable story, and it's something we touched on a few times in this podcast of how interesting it's been for a team that, you know, has, if when you look at the constituents of its parts, on paper it doesn't look like a side that would be anywhere near a Champions League, but it just shows that if you have a cohesive system, the guys collectively work together as a unit, and you're well organized, that you can take players to another level. And I think Chris Wilder has definitely done that without a doubt.
We've on the podcast as well, and I think even on the website and everywhere, we've touched on Sheffield United's tactics quite a bit and their strengths, but I will go over them here as well. So Wilder has stuck to a back three this season. It's usually been a 3-5-2. Every player is extremely well-drilled. They all know their roles. He's benefited from the fact that he puts out almost the same team every week. So they all know each other's roles. They know each other's movement. They know how to play with each other. That really helps. They have that cohesion. And tactically, I think I want to focus on the defensive side of their game first, because they have done extremely... They have the second best record in the league this season defensively. They've only conceded... they've conceded the second least number of goals. Liverpool have conceded 15, and they're second with... I think they've conceded, what, 24? Yeah, 24 goals this season. And they've kept... they're level with Liverpool, or maybe there's like one or two. I think they're the same in terms of the number of clean sheets they've kept as well. So they've done extremely well defensively, and that's to do with the fact that... And they've done that, you know, they've not really... It's not like they press high up the pitch. It's usually a medium block that they form. And especially against sides like City, Liverpool, even Arsenal to an extent, teams who hog the ball or are expected to keep the ball, Sheffield United are very comfortable against such teams, because that allows them to form a sort of back five with the wing-backs dropping in, and then the three midfielders in the centre screen the centre. So it's a very concerted effort to keep the ball away from central areas. The entire defensive line shifts across, not just defensive line actually, the entire team shifts across based on where the ball is. And they make the team in possession, the attacking team, they basically have to go around the block, because they are playing a mid-block, and the defense is positioned deep enough that a long ball over the top won't catch them out. So you have to almost go around the block, and their pressing triggers are basically when the ball is out wide, or it's with the winger or the fullback on the touchline. That is when they sort of try and pressure the player on the ball to force a throw-in, because obviously the touchline forms a natural barrier. So that's when they sort of apply pressure at times, but it's usually they're quite happy to sit in a mid-block and force the opposition to create a chance by going around the block or try and find space in between the lines, which is almost non-existent, because again, the three midfielders do a great job of screening that midfield as well. So, of screening that defense. So, I think defensively, it's been remarkable. It's there in the stats and everything as well. But even if you, from the naked eye, if you look at a Sheffield United game live, if you've ever seen them, you will see how well organized they are. And that's all down to the organization and the tactics that Chris Wilder has been employing.
Yeah, definitely. I think, like you said, that the shape they have naturally puts a lot of bodies, you know, through the middle of the park. And with that, you do need mobility in terms of from the midfielders and the wing backs to move up and down across horizontally. But you know, it's interesting. You see, even teams, even you know, City and these type of teams who are usually so good at breaking down deeper defensive have struggled because they'll go into the fullback areas and then they do really well to lock them to one side. So let's say the left back gets the ball, you know, the strikers come around, the other striker drops onto the nearest DM, and they really tend to lock off well to one side, which is, I think, something that's underratedly hard to do because you have to have excellent pressure on the ball from behind. You have to have everyone marking well to show them down that side and if a ball gets played into somewhere where they can win it. Because obviously teams who sit a bit lower, and especially with that 3-5-2, 5-3-2 formation, it can become very easy for the opposition just to go from side to side if you don't lock them to one side properly. And I think Sheffield do that brilliantly. And it's just such an underrated art of defending kind of principle that I think goes somewhat unnoticed. And like I said, it's just, again, hats off to Wilder for not only having the tactical awareness to put it in, but it's also getting the players to be willing to go and do those runs, to shift across quickly, to get your strikers to come down and help out in defensive phases. So I think it's, yeah, like we said, it's, I can't have enough praise for Wilder for what he's done.
I think slightly a little bit off from the tactical point of view, I think Chris Wilder really have magic in terms of his coaching, because when we saw the players they got in last summer, they are not really signing any big names players or something. Some players very a lot of experienced Premier League players, because for example, the striker McBurney, Billy Sharp, McGoldrick, they are spending the most time of his career in Championship or lower division. But when they're playing in the Premier League, they show passion, or they show confidence to play in the Premier League. So I think Chris Wilder really have the ability to boost the performance, to give confidence to the players, so let them to play in a more typical Chris Wilder manner. I mean, we know the overlapping centre backs or the back five or back three shifting across. So, and from a tactical point of view, I think tactical flexibility is very important to Sheffield United, because for example, they have the confidence to keep the ball at the back when they are not being pressed, and when they got chance or they are being pressed, they have confidence to play long, and they have the physicality to win the ball at the center of the pitch, picking up the second balls, because they are strong from winning those balls. And I mean, they are very flexible. If you press them, they just go long, and physically they are a very hard team to beat also. And if you play shots, and yeah, they can also play shots to attack. So I think they are a very good team to watch.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think, like you said, you know, they aren't opposed to playing a bit more direct. They've got, I think, from statistics, were the top in the league for longer balls. And interestingly, we're sixth in the Championship, which maybe gives you a good comparison of kind of the directness of teams coming up from the Championship. But like I said, people, and I think this is one with Klopp as well, that there's teams who play long and they don't have a shape, and there's teams who play long into specific areas with specific overloads and a very clearly defined way of how they're going to play. And I think that's what's great about the Sheffield United side, is that whatever phase of play they're doing, whenever they're doing it as a collective unit. Everyone's on the same page. Everyone understands. So even when they're going long, they're going into, you know, for example, we've seen a few times they'll get the wing backs high, they'll get the strikers over to one side. So, for example, the right wing back might go, and they'll play long into overloads of the right wing back, one of the midfielders, and a striker, and they all tuck across. And so they increase the chances of winning the second ball. And so I think that's kind of been another interesting component of their style of play, and one that I think people, it's very easy for people to look at long ball football and just think that's just long ball. But there's often with certain teams, method to the madness. And just like you can have teams who don't play well in possession in terms of trying to keep the ball and you know, be a bit naive, or not naive, but teams who will keep the ball for long periods but maybe don't have much end product. Just like you can have bad possession sides, you can have bad long ball sides, and I definitely think they do it better than most. I think that's another thing that's maybe gone under the radar with the side, and something that's comes back to the main point that they are just so well drilled in every single moment of the game. Each player knows what they're doing. They're all on the same page. And like Max said, they're doing so well to, you know, Chris has given them the confidence to believe in that kind of game plan. And then we see them result on the pitch. So, yeah.
Yeah. But just to sort of, I mean, I Sheffield United have been one of my favorite teams to watch this season as well. But there are a bunch of things which I think they can work on as well, or that are a weakness. And one of this is undoubtedly their goal scoring ability. I mean, they've scored only, 28 odd goals? 28 goals in 26 games. They're 15th highest in the league for goals scored. I mean, Aston Villa, Southampton, Brighton, Burnley, all of these teams have scored more goals than Sheffield United this season. So it is their defensive play. The fact that we've already spoken about their defensive acumen and their tactics, and the fact that they're they've conceded the second lowest number of goals in the league this season. That is, I think, what has propelled them to this position in the table, because the attacking side of their game isn't as well developed, I think. When I say this, I mean, I don't mean this exactly in terms of tactics, because as Luke said, they do try and create, their primary, I think, aim is to try and create overloads in the wide areas. And that's where the overlapping centre-halves come into play as well, where one of the centre-halves could go. They have a wing-back there as well, one of the wider midfielders moves in, say if it's the left-hand side, and one of the two strikers goes there as well. So, you know, you've got four players in that left-hand zone of the pitch, as one example. So, they do try and create overloads in wider areas to try and get the ball ahead, which a number of teams this season are doing, you know, through various means. Liverpool are one of the biggest examples of teams of who progress the ball through wider areas. We spoke about Everton as well, you know, so even Chelsea to an extent. So it's not that tactic itself is flawed, but I think they don't have the individuals for that in terms of goal scoring. Because as Max said, the three strikers that they have in the league this season, Billy Sharp, David McGoldrick and Ollie McBurnie, they spend the majority of their careers in lower leagues. And while they obviously have passion and heart and grit and determination and all of that, I don't think they're at a Premier League standard in terms of being able to score goals. And especially if you look at, the one, an intriguing stat is the big chances missed stat. If you look at individuals, we were talking about Chelsea and their goal scoring issues earlier this season. And it shows up there as well in terms of, you know, Tammy Abraham has missed the most number of big chances this season. He's missed 16 big chances as defined by Opta this season. And David McGoldrick is fourth on that list. He's level with Sadio Mane and both of them have missed 15 chances. But the point is that Sadio Mane puts a number of those chances away as well, right? David McGoldrick is just one example of a Sheffield United attacker who I don't think is at that level yet. Or, I mean, who knows if he'll ever be there. He's 30 plus, I think, in terms of age as well. So it's not like he's the answer for Sheffield United from an attacking point of view. They've done what they can with the strikers that they have. But from an attacking point of view, I think definitely they need to step up their game. And that's, I think, where even for the rest of the season, they might just get found out. I don't think they might just falter. They may not have enough goals in them. But it hasn't proven to be a problem so far. They are sixth in the table after Spurs winning today. They're sixth in the table right now. But they are in a sharp, definitely in the mix for a European spot, you know, Europa League or even potentially Champions League. But attacking-wise, like I said, I think there is a lot of work to be done. I think in the summer, they need to probably recruit a better class of attacker, a better quality of attacker, strikers or even wider forwards and all of that. And if they do manage to qualify for Europe, the additional funds that will bring in, all of that should help them do that. But for this season, I think if they do fall short, I think it will be because of the lack of attacking firepower and attacking quality. You know, defensively, they're superb, one of the best sides in the division. Overall as well, you know, tactically, We've all spoken about it on previous podcasts here. It's all on our website as well. One of the best sides in terms of tactically, you know, organized and well, of how tactically organized and well drilled they are. But yeah, I think they might just struggle if they don't manage to score enough goals. That might be just what makes the difference at the end of the season, where that might just be the difference between a Europa League spot and a Champions League spot, I feel, for Sheffield United. But yeah, so that was today's podcast, guys. Chelsea, Everton, Spurs and Sheffield United were the teams we sort of looked at in the race for a spot in Europe. Obviously now, this season, the team finishing in fifth is going to get a place in the Champions League as things stand. So that makes it a lot more competitive. Teams which we previously thought may not have a chance of playing in the Champions League now actually do have a chance, and there's hope for the likes of Arsenal and Manchester United as well, because obviously they can finish fifth and potentially play in the Champions League next season. So let's see how that goes. Let's see. There's a big game in this in terms of this race for the top four, top five, this, with Chelsea versus Manchester United as well. So by the time this comes out, I think that result would already have would have been there, and you know, the game would have been played and all of that. So we'll see how that goes. But for the next episode, we will be covering the next sort of bunch of teams who we think are in contention for a place in Europe. So say the likes of Wolves, Manchester United, Arsenal, even maybe, you know, Newcastle, Burnley, even all of those teams are in with a shout, but we'll take a call on which teams to cover. Let us know if you want us to cover any of these, you know, if you want us to look at Newcastle or Burnley a little more closely in terms of the fight for a European place, do let us know. Tweet us at Total Football Analysis, and yeah, check out, like I said earlier as well, check out our work on the website. We're on YouTube as well. We're on Twitter. Let us know what you guys think, feedback, and if there's anything else you want us to cover. But in terms of today's episode, that's it. I think Mac, Luke, great having you guys here.
Thanks for having us.
So yeah, I probably will have both of you on for next episode, for the next episode as well. So yeah, that's it from all of us, guys. Have a good one. Cheers, and keep listening to us.